This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about memory, how it works, and sometimes how it is that it doesn't work the way we would like. Our guest is Daniel Schachter, and he's chairman of Harvard University's Department of Psychology, where he researches aspects of both memory and amnesia. And we'll be talking about a new book that he's written, which is entitled The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. It's published by Houghton Mifflin, and it takes a look at seven common memory lapses, the kinds of things that really plague almost everybody from time to time. The fact that memories do decay over time, that phenomenon we've all experienced when someone comes up to you on the street and you know that you know them and everything about them except that you can't remember their name. And also the idea that some people may tell you that they have very, very clear memories of places they've gone, experiences that they have had that in fact never occurred at all. We'll talk about these and some other subjects this morning with Professor Schachter take whatever comments and questions you may have. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and a toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point you have questions, you're invited to call. Professor Schachter, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
It seems that we are, maybe a little bit, particularly people of a certain age, are preoccupied with the issue of memory and forgetting. It seems to be yet another one of those things that baby boomers like to worry about, that, the first time it is you can't remember where you put your car keys, then immediately you've decided, well, it's Alzheimer's disease, and it's just going to be downhill from there. And the fact of the matter is that in a variety of ways that we can talk about, memory doesn't always serve us as well as maybe we would like, and that in fact is quite normal, and maybe in there are good reasons for memory in the way it works and the way it doesn't.
Yeah, I think that one of the keys for people who are worried about their memories, particularly people who are getting older and experience episodes of forgetting, is to understand some of the basic ways in which memory fails, some of the differences between them, and what kinds of things are worrisome and possible indicators of a serious condition like Alzheimer's disease, and what kinds of things are completely normal. And I guess that's where the Seven Sins concept and the Seven Sins book based on that concept can be helpful, because basically what I try to do is provide a framework for thinking about different ways in which memory can let us down.
Memory does fade, and I think in the book you make the argument that that's probably necessary. One can't really expect to remember everything that you've
right.
ever experienced in your life. And there are some things that you don't really, maybe you don't need to remember that thing anymore. Is it predictable the way that memory fades, and does that change in a predictable way as one ages?
Yeah, I think what we want to talk about here are the first two of my seven memory sins, which I call transience, and that refers to the natural tendency of memory to fade over time, all other things being equal, and absent-mindedness, which is more of a memory failure due to a failure to pay attention and take information into memory. So let's first consider transience. One of the basic features of memory is that, as I mentioned earlier, all other things being equal, it's harder to remember, as we all know, what happened, let's say, 3 months ago than what happened yesterday. Sometimes we can remember the distant past very well when we rehearse and talk about experiences from the distant past, but if we don't, then there's kind of a natural fading or gradual inaccessibility that occurs. And to some extent, that's accelerated with normal aging, but not to a great extent. In other words, memory tends to fade, and maybe it fades a little bit more as we get older. But when you look at a serious condition like Alzheimer's disease, there you see a dramatic acceleration of what I call transience, and a dramatic speed-up in forgetting of recent experiences. To give one example, it's an old example now. Way back in the 1980s, I tell it briefly in the book, but it illustrates what a really severe case of transience can be like. There's a patient who I was studying many years ago, and we shared a common interest in playing golf. And one day I took him out on the golf course just out of curiosity to see how memory would manifest itself in a patient with such a significant memory disorder in a natural environment. And there was one incident there that really illustrates what I mean when I talk about a severe acceleration of transience. This guy hit a wonderful tee shot carrying over a creek about 150 yards down the fairway. He was excited about it. He was thinking about his next shot to the green. He did what cognitive psychologists call elaborative encoding. He thought about the event in a way that would normally produce very durable memory, would hold up well over time, and he'd be, you know, telling all his friends about this for weeks and months later. Then I got up, hit my drive, walked off the tee, turned around, and there he was teeing the ball up again. I said, what are you doing? And he said, well, I want to hit my tee shot also. Don't you remember you just hit that great tee shot? He had no recollection whatsoever of what he had just done. So that is transience at its extreme. He encoded the event in a normal way. He took it in, appreciated it, but it was gone within minutes, so far as we can tell. And that is a characteristic features of Alzheimer's disease, this great acceleration in transience. Now, you mentioned earlier, people often get worried that they're headed for such a devastating condition when things happen like they can't remember where they just put their keys. And I have found, particularly in talking to people in relation to this book, that that is very, very common. And I think what's going on here is a confusion between transience, which we just discussed, and the second sin of memory, which I call absent-mindedness. When we forget where we just put our keys a few minutes ago, we may get worried because we think, my God, my memory can't hold on to information for more than a few minutes. We may think that we're becoming like that guy I played golf with. He couldn't hold on to information for more than a couple of minutes. But in fact, most of the time, I think there's another explanation, namely that the information was never encoded in memory properly to begin with. We're preoccupied with other things. We're thinking about other things. We operate on automatic. We put our keys in an unfamiliar place. The information is really never taken in a way that it could be remembered later on. Then we panic a couple of minutes later because we think, my God, I just took this action a couple of minutes ago, and I can't remember it. So absent-mindedness, though very irritating and annoying, I think of it as the most annoying of the seven memory sins, is not any necessary indication of serious condition. It may reflect, you know, in part the circumstances of one's ever, you know, over busy life and so forth. But the two can be confused, and I think can lead people to needless worry. Hmm.
We have a caller to talk with, and we'll do that, and would welcome others into the conversation. Perhaps I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Daniel Schachter. He's the chairman of Harvard University's Department of Psychology, where he does research on memory and amnesia. He's written many articles on his research that have appeared in scholarly journals. He's also appeared on many programs on the Discovery Channel, 2020, PBS's Scientific American Frontiers, programs like that. And his book that is out now, if you're interested in reading about memory and how it works, the book is titled The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers, published by Houghton Mifflin. We do have a caller to start out here with, N. Gaze, and that is line number four.
Hello. I just want to gush for a moment. I'm a tremendous fan of yours, Dr. Schachter. I'm a psychology instructor at a local college, and I've used your seven since you first published an article in American Psychologist. Mm-hmm. And you say that they're sins, but also that they are very adaptive, because if our memory were just set in stone, we would have too much going in. I also use the clip that you had with Alan Alda on Scientific American in my classes, and it's only when I use your little trick of the memory task with bed and sleep and everything that I can convince my students that their memories are not as good as they think they are. This might be getting a little bit off of what you've been talking about, but you had mentioned that you had done a study, and the only way to tell a true memory from a false memory in this one study was in the auditory cortex. There was a slight difference in the subjects. I'd like to know if you've done any more work on that since that early study on the 12 subjects, and whether indeed it's only in the auditory cortex that we can tell true from false memories. I think I've gone on long enough.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for your interest in my work. I appreciate that, and the interest in the seven sins. Let me take up your first point, which I think we alluded to earlier. I do argue in the concluding chapter of the book, I try to make the argument that indeed these things that I call sins are adaptive features of memory in the sense that you point out and was alluded to earlier. For example, with transients, the argument would be that as time goes on, if you don't use and recall and strengthen a memory in some way, the chances are that you're not going to need that information in the future. And so in essence, it's a good thing to let those memories become more inaccessible, because unless you bring them up and use them, chances are you're not going to need them, and you don't want to overload the system with more information than it needs. And a similar spirited argument for absent-mindedness, which is that one of the reasons why these absent-minded errors occur is that we don't automatically take in every aspect and every detail of our experience. Every time we put our keys down, we don't automatically record like a camera everything that's happened, and nor would we want to, because we would run the risk, again, of being overloaded with all kinds of trivial details. Our memories work in a very different way. They're more selective and dependent on encoding processes that select certain aspects of the environment for processing in a way that can result in enduring memory. So that's a very important point. Second, you raise the issue about true and false memories. This gets us into the domain within the seven sins framework of what I call misattribution. This is one of the sins of commission, where memory can be present but wrong. So you remember some aspect of something that happened, but you misremember the time or place. You were referring to a wordless technique that's become popular in experimental psychology recently, in which you can induce false memories or false recognition of a sort by presenting list of associated words. So, for example, as you know that I've done with your class, apparently successfully, if I say candy, sour, sugar, bitter, good, taste, tooth, nice, honey, soda, chocolate, heart, cake, eat, pie, and I ask you to remember those words, and I later give you a memory test, if I say, was the word taste on the list, and listeners out there can test their own memories, many people will think it was, and it was. If I say, was the word point on the list, most people will say no, it wasn't, and in fact it wasn't. And if I say, was the word sweet on the list, most people will say yes, and they'll be quite confident that it was, but in fact it wasn't. Those were all words related to sweet, and some of you listening to the show may have just had the experience of a false recognition yourself. You'd be fairly confident that I said sweet when I didn't. We did a brain imaging study using PET scanning a number of years ago, as you allude to, where we put people in the scanner and we tried to see whether there are any differences in brain activity when you're remembering words like taste that were on the list and you remember, and words like sweet that weren't there but you think you remember. And in that early study, we did find a difference in the auditory cortex. We've done some more studies, as have others since then, and it really looks like there are certain differences that do appear between true and false. There are many similarities. The similarities tend to outweigh the differences. But whether you see it in the auditory cortex, we have a more recent study that's come out, just been published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The lead author on it is Roberto Cabeza from Duke University, where he finds some very interesting differences between true and false in parts of the medial temporal lobe, the inner parts of the temporal lobe. So it looks as though it very much depends on how the experiment is set up, what the test conditions are, as to whether you see brain differences and where those differences are between true and false memory. So that work is really still at a very early stage. There's a lot more to do.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, we've talked here about the notion of the fact that memory does fade and that it's probably necessary that it does, that you can't remember everything, and that what happens is that the brain is kind of making a bet that if there's some particular piece of information that you haven't used, and that maybe it's something that you actually don't need to remember. It is also, of course, true that some people will have memories, perhaps a memory of some experience. And as you point out later in the book, sometimes it may be a very bad or traumatic experience, something that they will never forget.
Right.
How is it that indeed there are some things that are so firmly, seem to be so firmly implanted in our memory that even if we would like to forget them, we can't?
Yeah, it's an interesting feature of memory that it can kind of cause problems going both ways. We want to remember, we forget some things we want to remember, and then as you allude to, we sometimes remember things we wish we could forget. This relates to the seventh sin, which I call persistence, and basically refers to the phenomenon you describe, usually as a result of emotionally arousing experiences, quite often negative or even traumatic experiences. We have these intrusive memories. They persist. We can't get them out of our minds. I tend to look at this again through the adaptive perspective that we talked about earlier. One of the good things about memory is that we tend to, all of things being equal, have exceptionally good memory for events that result in emotional arousal during an experience. So if we're aroused, either positively or negatively, we tend to have very good memory for that event. And again, one can see that this is a feature you want to have in memory. We seem to have specialized circuitry that's dedicated to processing emotionally arousing events. And this is a positive feature of memory in that you want a system that is going to do particularly well with respect to preserving information about experiences that might threaten your survival, for example, so you can avoid those things in the future. However, the price we pay for this exceptionally good memory for emotionally arousing events is that we sometimes can't get them out of our minds, even though we wish we could.
Going back, I realize we're sort of jumping around a little bit, but going back to the idea that there are the sins of omission and commission. One of the troubling sorts of memory lapses that and probably everyone experiences is the one where you're walking down the street and someone comes up to you and starts talking to you, and obviously they know you, and actually you know them. You know them. Maybe you could supply some details about who they are and what they do, and you know why it is you know them, but the one thing you cannot remember, their name. And why is it that seems to be you would recognize the person, and you might have access to other information about them, but this one key item, their name, somehow you can't summon that up?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a very striking memory failure. We've all experienced it, and it relates to sin number three in the seven sins, which I call blocking, which is basically a phenomenon you describe. And one key to understanding these blocking episodes is that they tend to occur most often for proper names, as in your example, names of people and places. And one idea that makes some sense as to why this occurs so often, or predominantly for proper names, is that if you think about it, proper names are stored, in a sense, separately from other kinds of information in memory, or have weaker links to other kinds of information in memory than common names do. They're stored in a more isolated manner. So the example I like to give is what psychologists call the Baker-Baker paradox. If I tell you that my friend's name is Baker, that really tells you nothing about that person. It doesn't provide you access to other associations or information or anything. It's just a meaningless sound. Essentially. On the other hand, if I tell you that my friend is a baker, you immediately can think of where he might work, things he might do, clothes he might wear, and so forth. So there's easier access to other associations and semantic networks in memory from common than from proper names. And so one idea is that this is why they're susceptible to blocking, because there's more of a fragile link between a proper name and other information in memory. Now, exactly why it is that that fragile link sometimes becomes disrupted is still not well understood.
And I guess that's why it is frequently that if people have difficulty remembering names, or maybe you're in a profession where it's very, very important for you to remember names of your customers, names of people that you deal with, that one of the tricks is often suggested is that developing some sort of image association with the person's name, so that then you can have something to grab onto. And that indeed would, I suppose, if the person's name really was Baker, that would help, but that there are other sorts of things that that will help you, some image that you can summon that will help you grab onto that person's name.
Yeah, anything that you can do with names to make them meaningful, either through images or associations, to construct some sort of meaningful links is going to be enormously helpful, because on their own, they sort of tend to stand alone. So that is very important for encoding new names into memory. I do talk about various things people can do to deal with each of these seven sins. Now, with blocking, once a retrieval block has occurred, it's difficult to do much to counteract it. People have various strategies. You know, they go through the alphabet trying to think of letters of the block name. Sometimes a helpful thing is simply to turn your attention away from the blocking incident, because often what happens is that we'll come up with a similar name or a similar word, and that makes us feel really close to the target item, so we kind of focus our attention on that because we think that we're on the verge of getting it. And some studies suggest that that actually can prolong the blocking state, focusing on a related name, because it creates interference that makes it more difficult for you to get to the actual correct name. So that may be why sometimes, you know, you just turn away and it pops up later, because you give a chance for that interference to kind of dissipate. Another thing I recommend is taking more of a, which will work in some situations in blocking, is taking more of a proactive stance. In other words, suppose you know that you're going to a business meeting, there are going to be people there you haven't seen frequently or recently. It turns out that those are the kinds of proper names in which we're likely to block people who we're familiar with, but we haven't used their name recently or frequently. One thing you might do is try to get a list of who's going to be there and review that list before you go, thereby reducing the chances of a retrieval block occurring spontaneously and you being put in the embarrassing situation of not knowing the person's name, even though the person might expect that you would.
We have someone else to talk with here locally, Champaign, line one. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
I'm curious about people who forget events that happened and recall them totally incorrectly. An example is just recently, I went to Disneyland about 4 years ago with my sister and brother-in-law, and he has difficulty, he has bad arthritis, and so we used a wheelchair, you know, for him. He doesn't normally use a wheelchair, but since we were going to be walking around a lot, he thought this would be helpful. I just saw him the other day, and I don't know how it came up, but I sort of casually mentioned it, and he said, "Oh, no, I never used a wheelchair." And I was just curious, you know, that he totally didn't remember this.
When was the time when he...
It was about 4 years ago.
And did you further probe?
No, because it seemed to make him uncomfortable, so I didn't push it, and I just
he
dropped it.
He said he had never used a wheelchair?
Pardon?
He said he had never used a wheelchair?
Oh, he may have. I don't know. I don't, you know, we don't live near each other, but in this instance, he used a wheelchair.
Right.
But he seemed to be upset that I even suggested that he used it. So I thought there's no point in pursuing it if it made him uncomfortable.
Right.
There was another incident where that was even more extreme. When my daughter was born, my then husband, we were living in Seattle, but I moved to I had the baby in Miami, and he mentioned to my daughter at one point how he remembers vividly when she was born, and he wasn't even there. And I told her not to push it, you know, if he feels better thinking that if he remembers it that way. And I'm just curious about people who totally remember things wrong.
Right. Well, in this latter case, it's very interesting and may relate to, again, a couple of the memory sins that I call misattribution, which we discussed earlier, another called suggestibility, and another where memories are implanted through suggestions. It may have been, you know, years ago in conversation, somebody suggested to him that he had been there, and he incorporated that memory, you know, wished that he had been there, and then took it on as his own. There's a lot of research showing that it doesn't take all that much in terms of suggestion in order for people to begin to believe that they've experienced events that never happened, as in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there was a study, I talk about this in the chapter of the seven sins on suggestibility, that was carried out in the Netherlands a number of years ago following a terrible airline crash where an LL cargo plane crashed into an apartment building in the suburbs of Amsterdam and, you know, wreaked havoc, all kinds of damage to property and people injured, and just a terrible scene. A few months after the incident, a group of Dutch researchers asked people who were in the university community, and this thing had been widely covered in the news, do you remember the television footage of the moment that the plane hit the building?
Mm-hmm.
And a significant proportion, more than a majority of these people, said, yeah, I do remember that moment, and went on to elaborate various details of the angle at which the plane hit the building and what happened right afterwards and so on. Now, that all might seem fine, but there was one problem, which is that there was no television footage of the moment that the plane hit the building.
Mm-hmm.
So this very mild suggestion, do you remember the moment, the television footage of the moment the plane hit the building, was enough for people to start conjuring up images maybe of other television coverage they'd seen, you know, a few days or weeks later, and construct that into a memory of an event that never happened, and similar processes could be operating in the mm-hmm. case you mentioned.
Yeah. But, you know, this person who absolutely denied ever using...
Well, then we get back to transience. It's remarkable, some of the events, you know, assuming that this was his best memory and just wasn't a case of being socially embarrassed or something of that nature. It's remarkable some of the kinds of things that with the passing of time people will forget. Now, that's not to say that the information is totally gone out of his memory. One thing we do know from memory research is that seemingly forgotten experiences that you can't remember when prompted with one set of cues, you might remember when prompted with another set of cues. So if you had said, well, don't you remember, you know, when you went to X and X hospital or mm-hmm. some other detail, it's possible that you could trigger the memory.
Yeah, or we didn't have to wait in line because we had a wheelchair.
Right, something of that nature. There might be a way of getting at it.
Uh-huh, yeah. Thank you.
All right, thanks. I think, though, isn't it also true, Professor Schachter, that one of the things that we do with memory is that we attempt to rewrite history?
Yeah. Absolutely. This relates to the sixth of the seven sins. I call it bias, and it basically refers to the fact that memories are greatly influenced by our current knowledge, feelings, and beliefs. So it really drives home the point that memory is not a tape recorder. It's not just a recording of what's happened in the past and a playback, but it's more a construction based on aspects of what happened combined with aspects of the present situation. And there are many examples. I talk about five different kinds of memory biases in this chapter, but I'll just mention one, which psychologists call a consistency bias, which basically refers to the fact that we tend to rewrite history, our own history, and often in ways that make it consistent with our current feelings, knowledge, and beliefs. So there have been some very interesting studies done of people in married and dating relationships, and what the researchers do is track how the couples feel about the relationship at different points in time, and then later ask them to remember back to how they once felt. And one finding that's turned up in a number of studies is that if you're currently feeling good about the state of your relationship, you tend to remember the past state of the relationship as being better than you actually said it was at the time. Conversely, if you're currently feeling poorly, negatively about the state of the relationship, you tend to remember the past state of the relationship as being worse than you actually said it was at the time. So that would be one of many examples of how current feelings or, and also knowledge and beliefs can shape how we remember the past.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Daniel Schachter. He's chairman of Harvard University's Department of Psychology, where he does research on memory and amnesia. He's written articles for scholarly publications and has, of course, talked many times with people in the scientific community, but also is often interviewed in popular media. And he's authored a book that explores this territory, and if you're interested in the subject, you might look at it. The book is titled The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. We have several callers here lined up, ready to go. Let's go next talk with someone in rural Champaign on our line number two. Hello.
Hello. I have had an experience several times with older family members who either have various sorts of dementias or have had severe strokes that have damaged their memory and their cognitive abilities, and they normally cannot participate or understand a normal conversation that you might have, even though they may be sitting there and appear to be listening. Once in a great while, and with all these people, we've had an experience where it might be weeks or months between these events, but they are sitting there trying to participate, and they respond with a full sentence that is totally appropriate to the subject that's being discussed, maybe even using a proper noun, a name of something that you've never heard them use in years. I'm wondering if we know anything about how they are able to access memory for just a moment. I'm assuming that's what happens. Or is this just an accident, or what might be happening here?
It's a very interesting phenomenon. I haven't observed that myself because I tend to work more on the more on features of memory related to personal experience as opposed to producing sentences, understanding language, and so forth. Why that would be so, we don't know. It may be that part of the problem is in accessing the network of facts and associations psychologists call semantic memory, and we don't have a good understanding of why it would be that at one moment in time you suddenly can gain access, whereas most of the time you can't. Alternatively, it may be that the network itself is really degraded, and there just may be little bits and fragments of information that are still preserved, and somehow you tap into those occasionally. But it's an interesting observation. I don't think we have good answers for it.
Do you have any idea also something, a phenomenon I see a lot in older people, almost anybody that is older, and then people as they're getting older, tend to tell a story or an event, and even to the same person within a very short period of time, will repeat the whole thing again with no awareness that they just did this? And, these are generally normal people that don't have dementias or something. What phenomenon's happening there?
That may be that's probably, feature of transience or possibly misattribution, that as we get older, that kind of thing of repeating a story without remembering that we've told it before tends to happen. And it happens because people, as we get older, we're particularly prone to forgetting the context in which an event has occurred. So we may know perfectly well that we've told this story, but we may not remember that we've told it to this person before. And so that aspect of the event is forgotten, and people go ahead and tell the same story multiple times.
Is there any way that you know of where people can help their memory to keep them from doing this?
Well, that's an interesting one because, people hope or wish that there were some kind of general purpose memory cure out there that we could just tell you we'll do X, Y, and Z, and that'll be the end of your problems with forgetting. Unfortunately, there really isn't. There are things that you can do to deal with specific kinds of memory problems, you know, for transients. For example, if there's a certain body of information you want to remember, there are techniques that can help you take in that information in ways that will make it last longer. I review some of these in the chapter on transients. For absent-mindedness, the important thing is making effective use of reminders and cues. For the specific problem that you mentioned, I suppose just making someone aware of the fact that they do it and maybe putting them on guard in the future that they may want to do a more careful check of their memory before they proceed with the story. But that's a hard one to come up with a specific solution for.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning. When I turned 50, I began to lose my nouns. And, I tried to make light of it, but it was very embarrassing to see a fence before me but not find the word fence. And a friend suggested ginkgo biloba, which I started taking. And, I can't say I remember every noun, but I do pretty well. And I have read reviews of studies involving ginkgo biloba, and they usually say that it doesn't help memory very much. They've done studies, and people aren't better rememberers with or without the ginkgo biloba. But I found it very helpful, and I wonder if there are any studies that do say that this particular herb is useful for the kind of memory loss I was having.
I reviewed the literature on that in the chapter on transients, and I guess I fortunately come to the same conclusion that the others do who you refer to, that there really isn't much in the research literature that would suggest any general effects. There are a couple of studies that suggest some mildly positive effects in people who actually have diagnosed Alzheimer's disease. But I think we need more work. I know there are larger clinical trials going on, but in terms of the scientific literature as it now exists, there's really not much there that would encourage you to believe that ginkgo has any significant effects. Not to say that it doesn't or that it can't, but the literature really doesn't support that.
I understand that ginkgo biloba is a blood thinner. And it's been suggested that it thins the blood in the brain area. And I don't know if that's a scientific fact or not.
I don't know much about the actual mechanism of exactly how it works. But again, I think what we need are more studies. We do have anecdotal reports. You know, I've heard people who said, yeah, I took it and, you know, my memory seems to have improved. Others have said I took it and nothing's happened. Mm-hmm. So we just don't really understand very well what its effects are on memory yet.
If anybody's interested, I take Nature's Way. Gink Gold is the trade name, and it's ginkgo biloba, and it's 60 milligrams. And as I say, my nouns have come back. So I thought I would just pass that along.
Okay.
Glad to hear it.
Very good.
Let's continue. We'll have another Urbana person here. This is line number 1. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have 2 questions. One, whether any research has been done with the effects of nutrition and memory. And the other was that I was under anesthesia for a long time, like 9 hours. While a biopsy was done and then a complicated surgery was done. And when I came out of it, my memory had changed. My previous good memory had been auditory, and when I finished up and came out of that, I had lost that. And now I'm very much a visual memory person. And I guess I'll just hang up and listen to you answer those 2. Thank you.
Okay. Well, Professor Schachter, what do you think?
I've never heard of of anything quite like the last anecdote regarding the anesthesia effects of that actually changing the sensory modality of memory. You know, we know that anesthesia pretty well knocks out memory during an operation or during the experience itself, although there have been a few interesting studies. I participated in a couple of these myself back in the late 1980s and early 90s that have looked at memory and anesthesia from the perspective of what I've called the distinction between explicit memory and implicit memory. Explicit memory is the kind of memory we've been talking about for this hour. It's calling to mind facts and events and experiences from the past in a conscious way so that you re-experience an event, for example. Implicit memory is something that occurs without conscious awareness, where you're influenced by an event from the past, but you have no conscious recollection that the event occurred. And several studies have suggested that there's some implicit memory effects that go on during anesthesia. So if you read people a list of words during anesthesia, later on you present them the words and they'll say, "I don't remember hearing any of this. I have no memory." But if you give, for example, a free association test and you ask people to free associate to words that are related to some of those that they heard, they'll sometimes, you know, produce the words that were presented during anesthesia more than they would if they had not been exposed to those words during anesthesia, suggesting there's some influence. So I've never heard of exactly the effect that the caller describes, but there is some interesting work going on linking anesthesia and memory.
And as to the other question, whether we think that there's any anything to suggest that
nutrition
yeah. as you know, that eating a particular diet, for example, or using or supplementing particular things would improve one's memory.
Again, I'm not really an expert on that area. I'm not aware of research that has actually looked at that. I would suspect that, you know, it's possible through poor diet, lack of exercise, and other things that there could be a generally negative impact on cognition and memory as well. I might be more surprised to find that there would actually be nutrition that would boost memory above its otherwise baseline level. But I'm not really an expert in the nutrition area, so I can't give a firm answer on that one.
Okay. Let's talk with someone in Chicago. Line 4. Hello.
I was going to ask another question about photographic memory, but I'd like to comment on the last questions that were asked. There had been an observation that people who had to go a heart bypass or other heart operation, if they could avoid being on the standby machine, their memory would be more intact rather than those who are on a machine basis assistance. And then the other one about nutrition, not so much of what we're taking in the way of nutritional supplements, but to avoid certain things. Dr. Abraham Hoffer in Canada, in a book on smart nutrients and reversing and preventing senility, suggested, among other hypotheses, that having a hypoglycemic diet and is avoiding glucose levels that are too high and remaining at a fasting level, almost a hypoglycemic diet would be more beneficial for people, and they would have fewer strokes, and if they do have strokes, it would lead to a better chance of surviving with their brain intact. So to avoid processed sugar of any kind, it may be a helpful solution, as well as avoiding glucose solutions in hospital administrative care and nursing pregnant women and so forth. So, but going back to your question about that I have photographic memory, could you make any comment about this aspect?
Well, you know, photographic memory is an interesting concept, but it's also a fairly controversial one in that there's really no good evidence for photographic memory in the literal sense of the word. Some people do have very accurate memories and can give very detailed and accurate reports of things that have happened to them. But when you really put them to the test, there's very little evidence that the memory is actually photographic.
Probably just selective moments.
Hmm?
Probably some selective moments where they remember everything as clear as night and day.
Yeah, where they remember, you know, much of a situation. But when these kinds of claims have been tested in detail, there hasn't really been much evidence of true photographic memory. People with, you know, who can exhibit extraordinary memory usually are employing various kinds of mnemonic techniques such as using visual imagery or other like techniques that convert incoming information into much more memorable form, rather than there just being some photographic imprint that they read out.
Yeah, I've known some people that almost are like encyclopedic in their breadth and scope, and you'd think that they have a built-in memory capacity.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. But I think it's interesting, and one of the things that I think I came away from the book was with the idea that, in fact, that's the wrong model to think of a photograph or you think of a videotape or something as a way that memory is encoded. That's the wrong model because, in fact, we may indeed think that we have very clear memories of things, but that we may only really be remembering parts and that other things we're filling in, and that's one of the reasons why it is that memory is not so trustworthy and why, in fact, we might remember things that actually didn't happen or we would remember things differently than they happened.
Right. I think that's such a fundamental point, and it's one that I try to drive home in the book. And once you can get away from that misleading metaphor, I think, of you know, memory just as literal reproduction, then it's much easier to understand some of the errors and mistakes that can otherwise seem quite baffling and even shocking.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to finish. I'm sorry we have someone that we can't take, but certainly there is much more in this book, and I found it quite interesting. And if you'd like to read more about memory and common memory lapses and perhaps why they occur and what they tell us about the way memory and the brain works, you can look for this book that we mentioned. It's titled The Seven Sins of Memory. It's published by Houghton Mifflin by our guest Daniel Schachter. He's chairman of Harvard University's Department of Psychology. Professor Schachter, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.